I'm Jonathan Capehart here for Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. Earlier this month, the Obama administration announced plans for an ambitious overhaul of the U.S. detention system for immigration violators. The death roster among detainees has recently been revised upward to 104 from 90 since 2003, and there may be more that have not been disclosed. There are typically about 400,000 immigration detainees over the course of a year, and with no real direct oversight, there have been no routine abuses, and there have been routine abuses and mismanagement. Here to discuss the issues and remedies that are being proposed are Amy Fettig, staff counsel at the National Prison Project and co-counsel with the ACLU on some prison abuse cases, and Nina Bernstein, who has been covering this issue for the New York Times. Thank you both very much for being here.
Good to be here.
Good to be here, Jonathan.
Nina, let me start with you. How long have you been covering the treatment of immigrant detainees for the Times?
Well, I started writing about immigration for the Times in 2004, and it really wasn't too long before I got into this issue, not by design, but by chance.
And can you put the number of immigration detainees into some kind of perspective? Is 400,000 a lot?
Well, it is a lot, but the thing that people have a hard time getting their heads around is that at any one time there may be 32,000-33,000 people detained, but over the course of the year many people are shuttled through these beds. There's a vast range between people who might spend a day or a few days and people who spend years in immigration detention.
And did the number and treatment of immigrant detainees change after 9/11?
Yes. I mean, that, of course, your point is very well taken. There used to be just a few thousand beds, and the annual numbers were much smaller. There's been a ballooning of this detention system as the Bush administration stepped up immigration enforcement. And as Congress, gave billions of dollars, really, for adding detention beds, and many of them are operated by for-profit companies, mm-hmm. Others by county jails or some sort of hybrid of the two. Often you have some local jail or sheriff who works out a deal with a private operator and builds new cells. Mm-hmm. And so this system has grown up very rapidly in people's backyards. They're not even aware that they're immigration detainees, mm-hmm. Kind of down the road or around the corner.
And Nina, are most of the immigrants detained because they have some criminal past?
No. They're detained because they are accused of immigration violations. Mm-hmm. They're detained even if they are those who have a criminal past. They're not being detained because of a crime. It's a form of civil or administrative detention. They're being detained for the purposes of deporting them. That's mm-hmm. what it's supposed to be.
Amy Fettig, I'm sorry, I misspoke when I talked about where you're from. You're the staff counsel at the National Prison Project. So what kind of legal advice do immigrant detainees receive?
Well, they receive very little because they, unlike someone who's accused of a crime and detained in a jail, they are not entitled to an attorney. So essentially, you've got 400,000 people running through the immigration detention system in this country who don't have the benefit of counsel or legal advice. Oftentimes, they are actually detained, and they're not even able to contact their families. So a lot of these people they're disappearing from their homes and the streets, and then they are being shipped out to immigration detention centers that may be, you know, hundreds of miles from their home. So these folks are lost. They're scared. They don't understand their legal rights, and they have very little access to legal counsel.
And when these people are transferred, Amy, are their families notified when they've been detained or transferred?
The government does not notify them. Now, the detainee may be able to get a collect call through, perhaps. but it is not incumbent upon the government to actually notify these families. So in the cases that we'll be discussing today, a lot of times these folks are disappearing and their families can't find them, don't know what happened to them. Hmm. And it's very difficult to contact somebody when you're detained very, very far from home.
Mm-hmm. Before we get into some of those cases, do either of you know what the average stay is for a detainee?
Go ahead, Nina.
What I was going to say is that I'm not sure what the average is right now, but in a way, mm-hmm. It's not a very good number. It may be something like I think it's been reduced. I think it's gone down, and it may be as little as 13 days or something like that they may have come up with, or 30 days or something. I'm afraid I really don't remember mm-hmm. what the average is. But the problem is, as I said, that there's really a tremendous range, that the average is kind of misleading, because you can have someone who has, for example, actually tried to sign away any right to contest deportation, who's ready to leave, like this New York City cabbie whose death was almost disappeared from the public record, who nevertheless spends weeks or months in detention because, you know, maybe they're waiting for the plane to have a full plane, or maybe mm-hmm. They're waiting for his name check, you know, to go through security, or maybe because somebody is making $100 a day on keeping him in detention.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to know. But and then at the other end of the spectrum, you also have someone who's fighting for political asylum and is mandatorily detained under current law while they're appealing this a denial at an early stage. So places which theoretically are supposed to be for brief, you know, relatively brief stays mm-hmm. just for the purpose of deportation can turn into places that people are living in for five, mm-hmm. 6 years.
This is the Leonard LoPage Show, and Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard. We're speaking with Nina Bernstein of the New York Times and Amy Fettig of the ACLU Prison Project. Nina, you wrote last week, and it read from what you wrote, quote, "More than 1 in 10 deaths in immigration detention in the last 6 years have been overlooked and were omitted from an official list of detainee fatalities issued to Congress in March. The administration added 10 previously unreported deaths to the official roster and disclosed an 11th, which occurred Friday, and is that of a 24-year-old Ethiopian, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, Mr. Ngozi, and correct me, Nina. What did he die of?
As I recall, and this is not a death that I've investigated, but I think it was the after effects of a suicide attempt at a county jail where he had been held.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, my experience as a reporter looking into a lot of these cases is that whatever the account on paper, and sometimes they're incredibly sketchy. There's more to the story.
Mm-hmm.
What I have found as a reporter is that these deaths are like windows into a system which has been, at least until very recently, extraordinarily secretive. It's sort of a black hole of information.
Mm-hmm.
When I started this, I still remember vividly getting a call. Or rather getting an email from a lawyer I didn't know who had calls from two detainees at Elizabeth, New Jersey, who were very upset and worried about a fellow detainee who had either been pushed or fallen from a height, had been badly injured, but the guards didn't believe he was badly injured, and he'd been put in isolation, and by the time he finally had been taken to the hospital, he was more dead than alive. That was their account. And I wanted to just check on that. I went to, you know, immigration authorities, Immigration Customs Enforcement, and they ended up claiming that without his 8-digit alien registration number and date of birth and full name, they couldn't check. So, you know, and it was months later after a freedom of information request that finally got a list, the first list of deaths. There were 66 on that list.
Nina, on what grounds were those deaths not reported?
Well, it's rather that there wasn't a mechanism to require that they be reported, and I think there's been this a sort of secrecy overall because there's a kind of it's the Department of Homeland Security. There's a national security veneer, perhaps, that may be part of it. But it's more that the default position was not to provide the information.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Amy, the ACLU uncovered one of the 10 deaths that had gone unreported, that of Felix Franklin Rodriguez Torres, and he was 36. Can you tell us who was he, and why was he detained, and how did he die?
Well, this is probably the most recent death that we've uncovered as a result of our FOIA lawsuit. And that lawsuit has been going on since June 2008. And it was actually precipitated by our FOIA request, which we filed in June of 2007. Mm-hmm. And thereafter, we weren't able to get the records that we requested, the death records of everyone who had died in ICE custody since 2004. And as Nina says, this is because ICE and DHS...
ICE being?
The Immigration Customs and Enforcement Organization, which is the immigration arm of the Department of Homeland Security, mm-hmm. and they are responsible for the detention of immigration detainees. And the problems that we found was that no one, as Nina said, was responsible for collecting information. Unlike prisoners in jails and prisons across the country who have a mandatory reporting requirement of any death in custody, this does not exist for immigration detainees. And so this information was floating around. It wasn't being collected. Nobody was seemingly taking a look at it. And nobody could find it when they were asked to produce it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what precipitated the ACLU getting involved, filing a FOIA, and then having to file a lawsuit after a year when we couldn't get the information we were seeking, and which the Department of Homeland Security was obligated to provide.
Mm-hmm.
And this struggle has been going on for quite some time. We did eventually, as you said, very recently, in June of this year, finally get information about Mr. Rodriguez Torres.
Mm-hmm. And he was?
He was an immigrant from Ecuador. But I have to tell you that the information that we were given from ICE was very scanty. We noticed that it was an unreported death. It was a death that had fallen through the cracks, but there wasn't a whole lot of information. So when we received these documents, we went back to the Department of Homeland Security and ICE and said, look, there's another death here, but there are no medical records. There's no mortality review. There are a few emails and what's called a significant event notification that just basically sanitized the death of this individual and didn't give a lot of information about him. They appeared to be surprised. They didn't have the records either. And so they went back, looked through all of their records, and found out, lo and behold, that Mr. Rodriguez Torres wasn't the only individual whose death had gone unnoticed and fallen through the cracks. Indeed, there were a lot of other additional individuals, and that's what precipitated the announcement of these additional deaths by Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Well, I have to say that I think the other piece is that there's really a role for journalists, probably all over the country, to try to put flesh on the bones of whatever comes out of these records. The Rodriguez case, for example, in the documents that the ACLU got, the names of his sister, his father, were redacted. It was very hard to find out who he really was. In fact, he was someone who had settled in New York, whose family lives in Queens. His brother-in-law works for the MTA. I mean, in other words, someone with roots in mm-hmm. this community. And that actually takes reporting. You know, that mm-hmm. it's something that unfortunately there's not a lot of support, monetary support for at newspapers around the country, and it's something that's concerning, because that ultimately is, I think, what also pushed the government to come out with this announcement of these other deaths, because I had been calling them about Mr. Rodriguez's death and his case in the days immediately before that, and they knew that I was preparing a story about his case that would also reveal how this detention center where he died had a history of previous death.
Right, and we should point out, and correct me if I'm wrong, Nina, Mr. Rodriguez Torres died of testicular cancer in January of 07. This was after he had been detained 2 months at an immigration jail run by the for-profit Corrections Corporation of America in Arizona. And this is a place that had come under criticism in the past for poor medical care. Is that correct?
Yes, but we wouldn't have known that if it hadn't been for the ACLU's FOIA lawsuit, actually, because, again, it turns out that in these there had been, yes, there were these previous deaths, and the Times had reported, in fact, that there had been a number of deaths at Eloy, detainee deaths at this detention facility in Eloy run by Corrections Corporation of America. And there was one, in fact, that I had reported out, that I'd written about. But these two that were really in just the months previous to Mr. Rodriguez's arrival, we'd listed them, but what I didn't know was that there had been an investigation. There had been investigations by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. They had sent a team, and the results of that team's investigation were really quite scathing. And that is the pattern that in this case that is so shows how daunting the reform effort is if it focuses purely on the oversight issue. Oversight is crucial, but this pattern in this case, Eloy, showed that there was oversight. I mean, Immigration and Customs Enforcement officials were not in the dark. They had been told in two previous cases that the medical care was lacking, was inadequate, that detainee welfare was in jeopardy. But they were expanding, and they needed to presumably somewhere to put these detainees, and they were collecting them rapidly at places like Rikers, which is where Mr. Rodriguez was picked up. And, he arrives at a point where somebody should have caught the fact that he was suffering from testicular cancer.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk more about Corrections Corporation of America. I'm speaking with New York Times immigration reporter Nina Bernstein and Amy Fettig, staff attorney for the ACLU Prison Project, about why so many deaths in federal immigration detention facilities have gone unreported. We'll have more after a break. I'm Jonathan Capehart, in for Leonard Lopate. I'm speaking with New York Times immigration reporter Nina Bernstein and Amy Fettig, staff attorney for the ACLU Prison Project. Amy, before we went to the break, we were talking about Corrections Corporation of America. Now, you deal, of course, with prisoner welfare on a large scale. So what do you think of Corrections Corporation of America's track record?
I think it's fair to say that it's abysmal. Corrections Corporation of America and the other private prison companies in this country have really received a windfall with immigration detention. Prior to 9/11, these companies had really gone into disrepute. There had been so many problems in state, local, and federal jails and prisons with their management of prison, from abuse to lack of medical care to riots to overcrowding and a lack of training of staff, that they had really gone into disfavor and were losing contracts right and left. Then 9/11 came along, and suddenly there were a lot of federal dollars that needed to be invested overnight in immigration detention facilities. So these facilities that were formerly private prisons became private detention centers. And unfortunately, the track record that was established in the 90s by these companies is being reestablished. this decade in immigration detention.
And how does it compare to state and federal facilities?
Well, simply put, there's a profit motive. And so when your motive is profit, you're going to have to cut corners. And the way you do that is in training of staff, in the numbers of staff that you have, in the programs you provide, and especially in medical and mental health care. And we see that time and time again in the records of the deaths of immigration detainees, that folks are not receiving the mental and medical health care they need. And as a result, people are dying unnecessary deaths, and they're suffering in huge and avoidable ways.
But considering that for-profit prison companies like Corrections Corporation of America, they're getting federal dollars through federal contracts, there are no rules, regulations about record-keeping, health care, any of those things for these detainees?
Unfortunately, unlike government entities, Corrections Corporation of America and other private prison companies are not subject to FOIA. Mm-hmm. And so we can't get their records. So we don't know to a certain extent what's happening inside those facilities. Also, there hasn't been, ICE has failed to establish legally binding standards for the detention of detainees. In particular, its health care benefit package, which is something we discovered when we actually sued the San Diego Correctional Facility. It's a CCA facility, Corrections Corporation of America, that holds immigration detainees. And we sued them in a class action over medical care. And what we found, actually, was that Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, had what has to be described as your worst idea of an HMO nightmare. And under the regulations that the federal government has for immigration detainees, basically it allows discretion to deny any medical care that's not an emergency. So basically, if you're not facing death or dismemberment, there's a good chance you're not going to receive any care. And we saw this illustrated actually in the San Diego case, most painfully with a man named Francisco Castaneda, who developed penile cancer while he was in the care of the San Diego Correctional Facility. But he was continually denied an expert evaluation of his for a diagnosis, continually denied any treatment based on this HMO's feeling that his request for care was cosmetic in
wow.
nature. What ended up happening to Mr. Castaneda is that we, you know, a team of lawyers from the ACLU advocated for several months in order to just get him an appointment with a specialist. When the specialist saw him, they realized that the cancer had metastasized so far that ICE decided to let him go the next day. The next day, he immediately went to the hospital for an emergency operation in which his genitals were removed. Mr. Castaneda lived long enough to testify to Congress, but not much longer. That's a stark example of the kind of care that not only ICE but also these private prisons are providing,
you know,
to folks who have no other option.
Mm-hmm. Nina, this past spring, the New York Times reported on the case of Tanvir Ahmad, a 43-year-old Pakistani New Yorker who had been held in a New Jersey immigration jail where a fellow detainee said that he had a heart attack that was left untreated.
Well, that his symptoms of a heart attack had gone had been disregarded, had been ignored too long. You know, by the time they called, summoned an ambulance, it was too late. And I think this is one of the patterns that you see, both that the news of this kind of neglect gets out, it gets out through a fellow detainee or a relative, you don't find it out otherwise. It's kind of buried. But to be in custody, to have no way to drive yourself to the emergency room, and to realize that you're dying must be very, very grim.
Do these detainees have, say, a case manager assigned to them? Is that a crazy question?
There's a deportation officer,
okay.
Certainly. I think that there, one of the things in the Rodriguez case, when I talked with the relatives, that was quite disturbing was that the family said they got very worried when it was the sister told me she got very worried when her brother stopped calling, and he had complained earlier of being sick and he wasn't getting anything that helped him. And then he stopped calling. And so they call the deportation officer, who keeps telling them, oh, he's fine. And they actually don't find out the truth, which is that he's been at the hospital for a week and has a, you know, and is very sick indeed. They find out in a call from a fellow detainee who's gone through his belongings and found a number, a family number, and calls the cell phone of the mother in Queens, and he reveals to them that in the that for days he had been lying on the floor, unable to move, that they had been trying to get guards to pay attention, and he was being ignored. You won't find any of that in the significant event notification or significant incident report or these forms that have been FOIA'd by the ACLU lawsuit and that give this sort of official account, because as Amy said, it's sort of, you end up with a sort of sanitized version. And again, transparency here makes mm-hmm. all the difference. And that's why I think really the role of the Freedom of Information Act in this whole story should not be overlooked. Don't you agree, Amy?
Absolutely. It played an absolutely critical role. And I would also say that the role of the Times, and Nina in particular, in going that extra mile and doing this tremendous job of reporting and fleshing out the story and talking to the people, something that is never, ever going to be revealed in government documents, that has been the absolute critical key, really, to exposing what's a hidden national tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't have come to light because these are folks who have no advocates. They are hidden. Many of them are entering the country for the first time claiming asylum, so there's no one to contact. So they disappear. Without the FOIA, this would have been completely hidden. And now we're just finding out what's happening, and this stuff has been going on for years.
Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. We've spent a lot of time talking about individuals in the detainee system. So what happens in the case of an entire family being detained? Or are there facilities for families?
Well, there are, or at least there are two. And one, the Obama administration, in their announcement of a plan to overhaul the detention system, closed down, or rather said they're going to discontinue its use for families. And it's the, I have to say, notorious at this point, Don Hutto, family residential center
in Texas.
It's close to Austin, and it really and I think the Amy can talk about the ACLU suit regarding the Hutto, but it's certainly been the news media has and local activists have really put it on the map as well. Children as young as little kids, children under 10, until the suit, were in prison garb, couldn't have toys in their cell. Originally, I think the idea was that families who had been separated before, when a family was of either illegal immigrants or people seeking political asylum, were caught, the children were being separated from the mm-hmm. parents. The parents were being put in detention. The children were put in some kind of foster care. So the Bush administration was told, don't do that. You shouldn't do that. And so they come up with a way to keep them together, and they give the contract to the Corrections Corporation of America to set this up in a former state prison. And the consequences maybe Amy can talk about.
Absolutely. The Hutto institution is an excellent example, really, of the government's overuse of immigration detention. They were imprisoning whole families. And I say imprisoned for a very real reason, because the conditions were absolutely like being in prison. And as Nina alluded to, there were, you know, five-year-olds in orange jumpsuits, essentially, being subject to these conditions that were unbelievably psychologically harmful.
Really? In orange jumpsuits?
I don't think they were in orange
jumpsuits. I was like, wow.
They were in what the facility called scrubs. You know, they were. It was some sort of more like whatever.
It looked like a prison uniform.
It was a prison garb, not an orange jumpsuit.
Right. Okay. But,
you know, we don't need to go there.
The conditions, however, were very much like being in prison for the moms, the dads, and the children. And it's a good example of the overuse of immigration detention. Prior to 9/11, families would be released if they were not considered a flight risk or a threat to the community, a public safety concern. The vast majority of people who are now being detained are not threats to the public safety, nor are they flight risks. But the assumption is we're going to be locking up everybody. Now, that's been a Bush administration policy. It was part of a knee-jerk and extreme post 9/11 reaction. Unfortunately, what we've seen so far is that the Obama administration is willing to continue this.
Well, I have to interject here.
Yeah.
This is part, it's not just a post 9/11 thing. You know, clearly this is part of a larger and very polarized immigration debate. And to be fair, part of this family center was seen as sort of a centerpiece of ending the catch and release policy, under which many, many people would not show up then after they were released. Of course, they were given some notice to appear at an immigration hearing, but it was almost understood they were going to disappear and go work somewhere. And so the Bush administration, I don't know whether this has ever been proven, but certainly they were arguing that people were even adults were even renting children, because if they showed up with children, they would be released. And then, you know, and if the, so I think it's maybe a little more complicated. The part of the enforcement and part of the Obama administration's embrace of these Bush-era enforcement programs have to do with what the trade-off is going to be for a comprehensive immigration reform bill. And the idea, at least, whether it's right or not right, that in order to have any bill that provides a path to legal status for millions of people who are residents in this country without legal status, that you know, in order to get that, they're going to have to show that they're tough on enforcement, and that they're not going to just have a repeat of the past, you know, amnesty followed by opening the gates.
The Obama administration hasn't changed course at all.
I don't think that's accurate to say that they haven't changed course at all. Clearly, there are some differences, and I think that the decision to close Hutto was the clearest departure. There are some other things that, you know, like saying, like the push for more transparency, like this announced plan, which is going to be fleshed out, I think, more in a later report by Dora Schriero, the special advisor to Janet Napolitano, you know, on detention and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, I think the Obama administration has far more than a lot of immigration advocates expected. Has taken the Bush administration followed that line.
Nina and Amy, we've got 20 seconds left, but there's a great question from a caller. They just want to know: can you put the number of deaths into perspective? How does the number compare to the number of deaths in, say, state and federal prisons? 10 seconds.
I want to address this because I know the Bush administration was, or the ICE under the Bush administration was saying that the number is low, But in fact, it's apples and oranges.
Okay. I'm sorry to cut you off like that. My misreading of the clock. Nina Bernstein and Amy Fettig, thank you so much for being with us today. On Wednesday's show, NPR's Mike Pesca sits in for Leonard. We'll look at the state of the FAA and whether air traffic controllers are doing enough to keep the skies safe. Then award-winning investigative reporter Laura McClure of Mother Jones Magazine talks about the Landmark Forum, a leadership development group with a controversial philosophy. Also, director Wilt Stillman talks about the DVD reissue of his 1998 film, The Last Days of Disco. Plus, how blogging has changed the political and media landscape. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Fran Jacobs, Angie Sheldon, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Jonathan Capehart, in for Leonard Lopate. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.